Hello and welcome to Say That, the podcast where your big questions get real answers. My name is Matt King. I'm your host here in the city of Chicago. Joining us here is Jed Brewer.
Look, we've been together for a long time, and I'm not going to lie. I'm thinking about doing some solo work. It's probably, my working title is the Say This podcast. I want to basically do what we've been doing, just without any constraints on anything that I would do in any way ever. So, you know, that's something to look forward to.
Let me just pitch this, the Jed That podcast. And that's your advice to every question is you should Jed that. And then you explain what that means in the context. Also with us all the way from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Lee Younger.
The funny thing there, it goes a couple of ways. It's like when a cook prepares like, oh, we're going to do eggs three ways. One of the things is there was a podcast early on in our collective memories that some kid called the What Are They Saying Now podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
After we got some play. And the other idea, the other thing that I thought about on Jed's response is, I'm not aware of any limits that Matt puts on us. It's not like Jed's like, I got to get out there and really do my thing. I got to break the fetters of Matt King's, you know, disciplinary podcast hosting
my brutal
style.
Overbearing editorial hand that is constantly
this. Jed's like, Matt, your draconian style.
You've been keeping me down for too long, King.
It's what I'm known for. I was going to try to list like an entertainment level, entertainment industry figure in either like TV, movies, recording, who was known for like really a ruling with an iron fist, but I couldn't come up with any off the top of my head that weren't also guilty of other horrific things.
Yeah.
So I think it's best to keep that one vague.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Indeed.
Suffice it to say, Jed really needs to spread his wings.
I really do, man. If there's one thing about my life that I think everybody can see plain as day, it's that I'm constantly being constrained and held back.
Yeah.
No one will just let me be me.
No creative freedom whatsoever.
Yeah.
This is from a man who at any moment is liable to try the new flavor of Cheetos and Mountain Dew. In his 40s.
My life anthem at this point, like this is the chest piece tattoo I need, is you don't understand my music, Dad.
Yes. In this case, Dad being your friend and podcast producer.
Yeah.
Who plays your music at the end of every episode.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Even still. Making it very hard to rebel against, but Jed still finds a way, which is great.
Yeah, I need to rebel. It's all I've got.
We celebrate that.
We absolutely do. Here's a couple things we don't celebrate coming up in a Christians being normal emergency.
Oh,
you may remember from our last episode, we had a bunch of young gentlemen starting a Christian nightclub, which whether or not that was a good reason or not. One of the things they said was, we want to prove that Christians don't have to be corny. We want to prove that Christians can be normal. And
how's that going?
Uphill climb. This week, we have a couple of stories focusing specifically on worship music and people doing worship music and having even weirder opinions about worship music than you may have thought.
Uh-oh.
We start off. There was a thing, apparently, in the last month called, and I'm not making this up, the Shepherds Conference, shortened to ShepCon.
Oh.
For a bunch of pastors.
This is not for literal sheep herders, because that would be kind of interesting.
I feel like if they were going to be true to the allegory there, they should have at least a couple.
Yeah.
Did you go to the breakout buzz group on shearing?
Yeah.
It was can't miss.
Like, if you want to take the shepherd thing seriously, invite shepherds, preferably from the steppes of the Mideast, and let them teach you things that you can then apply to your pastoring.
I am so here for this. I am so here for this.
If you're going to be about it, I guess is what we would say to that. So instead, they had, you know, it was just a bunch of white pastors at a thing, and John Piper, I think, said something stupid, but I don't even care because the highlight is a dude on Twitter, pastor something or other, I'm not even getting out, I don't care, tweeted, Bob Coughlin, who I'm led to believe is the Sovereign Grace Music gentleman.
Okay.
Bob Coughlin leading congregational singing is all the reason needed to not attend Shepherd's Conference. Call it personal preference if you like, but there's a weird effeminate vibe I get from much of the modern attempts to write corporate worship music.
Wow.
And then, you know, people were like, a lot of people were like, hey, that's a really weird thing to say. And I know Bob Coughlin and he does nice work. And, you know, it's just people, what's wrong with people worshiping? And dude doubled down about how effeminate, again, it is for a corporate singing. So I guess the question I bring for you guys is worship too girly?
Wow. I feel like I must be missing something, but it is the first question that comes to mind. Just so I know, what exactly is wrong with being effeminate?
Yeah.
You know.
But I don't. I mean, that's the nature of my inquiry.
Oh, you know, the stuff.
Oh, I see.
Much like my conservative views that I get in trouble for. Not the ones related to, like, tax policy or national defense. You know the ones.
But wait, doesn't that book that we all say we love, isn't there a part where Jesus weeps openly in front of a crowd and says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I long to gather you under my wings as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. Doesn't Jesus essentially call himself a mother hen as he's weeping publicly and lament that he can't gather them under his wings like a mama hen?
Yeah, but he wasn't singing.
Lee, yes, for those of us who believe in the authority of Scripture, yes, technically Jesus did say those words, but we have no reason not to believe that he said them in the voice of the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Jerusalem.
Dude, I need the full recitation. I need that passage from the Macho Man.
I long to gather you under my wings. Oh, yeah. Like a hen.
A fully, let's go with chemically aided, Randy Savage in 1984. I think would cut a full 4-minute promo at Mean Gene about gathering the other wrestlers in the World Wrestling Federation under his wing, and no one would have batted an eye.
Yeah.
Okay. A point well taken. But isn't this book that everybody says they love in this movement, isn't this the same book where the Apostle Paul, like the main missionary of the whole like spreading of the Christianity, said that when I was with you, I treated you as a nursing mother treated her children, and I nursed you. Isn't that a thing that he said? And isn't that a very, very female image right there that a dude said?
Yeah, but again, didn't sing with a bunch of other dudes, and that's what makes me uncomfortable. And there's certainly nothing about singing in the Bible. So I looked up the weird dude who made this tweet. And so a lot of times, and I want to point this out, a lot of times we'll come across something and it's concerning because it was someone with a large platform. It was a John Piper or Mark Driscoll, whatever. This dude has like 800 followers on Twitter, which is like more than I have, but I also don't really tweet, so I'm not that concerned about it. He's also part of something called the Free Presbyterian Church of North America.
Okay. Free in what way exactly?
Well, I don't know, but according to their website, they have exactly 18 congregations in the world.
Okay.
They describe themselves thusly, and tell me if this makes you want to just hop on a plane to the nearest one and find out. The Free Presbyterian Church of North America is an intimate family of Bible-believing Protestants whose Presbyterian roots go back to the Great Reformation of the 16th century. Reformed in doctrine, evangelical in outreach, sanctified in behavior, Presbyterian in government, Protestant in conviction, separatist in practice.
Oof. Wow, that's a lot of words, man.
Yeah. And apparently the guy in charge of it is known as the moderator.
That is the most comic book movie villain name I've heard in a long time, bro.
Because there's a thing on the website that says, a word from the moderator.
Wow.
Do you think maybe that speaks to why they're a little freaked out by the idea of worshiping with your heart on your sleeve a little bit there? Like, hey, that made me call the moderator.
Wow.
I can definitely see a world where the Disney property Incredibles if they ever make a third Incredibles movie, that the villain would be called the moderator.
Yeah, I think that's good. I just kind of wants to take the edge off everything, turn the world gray. Here's another fun thing. So then you scroll down past the message from the moderator, and they have a one question Q&A. Next to a video, it says, what is the gospel? Salvation is more than giving right answers to important questions. But if you have no idea how to answer this question, we hope you'll take a few minutes to watch this video. And here's what I really appreciate about that. Somebody saying, you know, the salvation is more than giving the right answers to the important questions. But we don't have anything else. So please watch this 6-minute video where we give answers to questions. But so we move on from that to a possibly a different flavor of weird thing said about worship music this week. This is not someone from the Free Church Presbyterian Movement of North America or whatever criticizing ShepCon. This appears to be a very Gen Z worship thing. This is a bunch of people in loose fitting denim sitting in front of a giant screen that says Wild Ones on it. And the first, I'll just drop the audio in here, but this gentleman has a big thought.
That just provoked this thought in me, just that idea of you stare at the devil and you go, well, I'm going to sing my favorite worship song over you. What if he looked you back in the face and said, little do you know, I wrote that song. I wrote it. Number one, because he was a worshiper, so he cares about music. You think that the devil's number one agenda is to get you through music. That's why you crave it. And secondly, because so many of our worship songs are devoid of biblical literacy, I am tempted to believe the devil had a hand in writing it. What if he looked back at you and said, that's my favorite?
And his big thought is, what if it is the devil who wrote the worship songs that you sing? Huh?
Wow.
Did you ever think of that?
I think the devil would be a better songwriter. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah. I also enjoy, at first I thought, that's a sick burn on Chris Tomlin. But no, apparently they're going for something else.
Because like historically, right, like the last music that we've really attributed to the devil is Robert Johnson. And that dude, sure, like, revolutionized, like, a whole genre of music. And, in fact, like, all modern pop music is based on the blues. So, like, I think the devil would probably take bigger swings if he was getting back in the lab on music production.
Well, that's the point I kind of wanted to make out of this. We talked last week with the whole thing with John MacArthur calling the Gospel Coalition woke because of them celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. And it's just that weird, this kind of snake eating its own tail of this insular Christian culture bubble, but people still want to be as outraged and as like satanic panic as they were. So we've gone from Robert Johnson as the devil, which, you know, he wrote the song about selling his soul at the crossroads. So you have to say he brought a little bit out of himself. You know, then, you know, Led Zeppelin was the devil, and
the Beatles also the devil.
Beatles also the devil. That one made a little less sense. But, you know, your Zeppelin, your Black Sabbath were the devil. okay, they were trying to sound like the devil, I think.
Well, at one point, the devil went down to Georgia and lost a fiddle competition, I think. I mean, I'm not a great historian on the devil, but I think that happened to the devil.
He was way behind, implying that the devil has some sort of soul quota.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you wait, it's kind of like buying a car at the end of the month or the end of the quarter. If you wait until he's waiting to make a deal, you can get a better interest rate on selling your soul.
Looking for a soul to steal.
That's absolutely right. Well, and for the guy that was suggesting maybe the devil wrote the songs, like, I think that we maybe need to give the devil a break, because I got to be honest with you. If I lost a musical competition to Charlie Daniels, I would feel pretty discouraged and I would need to take a break for a while. And that's not been that long. I mean, like, the devil is a created being, so he's not infinite, but he's been around, you know, quite a while. So a few years is pretty short in his time span. So, like, yeah. I just, like, if you go through a bad breakup, like, it takes a while to be ready to get back into the dating pool. I don't know that Beelzebub is prepared to really do the music thing again for a while. I think he may need to take some time and heal. And I feel like the tweet was insensitive on that basis.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's true. So, you know, he was defeated in song. He was then he went to being represented by just some really lame bands. Like we've talked before on the show. If you think that Kiss is the Christian devil, come on, man. The song's about wanting to rock and roll all night and party every day.
Yeah.
Their drummer who wore cat makeup wrote a touching ballad about his wife. Yeah. This is Satanism should be made of sterner stuff. But then, you know, we bounce kind of back. So earlier this year, you know, Doja Cat was the devil for a little while. That was fun.
Sure. Yeah.
Sam Smith was the devil last year. I think Lil Nas X was recently the devil.
Yeah.
So that's all cool. But to look at it and be like, you know, it's really the Satan music. Worship, contemporary worship songs.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Well, how did you make the devil lame? At least the rock and roll people, they overcooked the devil thing a little bit, but they're going for some kind of style. You have to have sympathy for him. Even the Charlie Daniels version, he seems like a fun guy.
Sure, he's certainly trying hard on that fiddle, and no one's giving him credit for that.
Yeah, he's a good sport. He gives it up at the end.
You know, that's a really good point. There's no point in the Charlie Daniels narrative where the devil's like, it's rigged.
Yeah. Yeah, the devil went down to Georgia for a recount.
Yeah, he didn't. There was no thing where the armies of hell came out and did a Stop the Steal rally.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's
I would look forward for Dominion voting systems versus the devil in a defamation suit.
You know what? If my minions weren't cowards.
That's right. If Baphomet has courage, the devil can still win this fiddle competition. Yeah, you know what? I think that's a good place to leave it.
That was incredible. I am just delighted with everything that just happened.
I think on that, we're going to declare emergency off and move on to your fine questions. If you have a question for us, handle this all the way to the end, or you'll scroll down to your episode description, click the links you find there. Our first question comes in and says, how do I get better at being vulnerable, either in groups or with people one-on-one? And I think an excellent question. Vulnerability, one of those things that gets talked about a lot as a good thing, and we've talked about that over the years. But I like this idea of vulnerability as a skill and something you can grow and get better at. So, Lee, where do we start off with this?
Well, the main thing for me here is that there is value in vulnerability. And there is value in vulnerability in spaces where you are walking alongside and growing with people in your spiritual walk. But it depends, because I don't think there's a ton of value in vulnerability without solid relationship and relationships with people who have demonstrated trust. So I would say, you know, I think opening yourself up to people who have demonstrated themselves as trustworthy, demonstrated themselves as kind, as people who are skilled at empathy and generosity, the kinds of things that the kinds of things that make you feel safe to open yourself up. Because the whole thing about vulnerability is, if you expose your soft targets to somebody who doesn't know how to care for you, then that's a really unwise thing to do. If you expose your soft targets to someone who is manipulative, or somebody who takes advantage, or somebody that you can't trust, there's not a lot of value in that. We don't want to just say that vulnerability is a blanket good thing, no matter what. If you're going to have a small group, then you got to have vulnerability. What I would say is, I would say to anybody, let me just take a, for instance, that doesn't have anything to do with a Christian community type of situation. Let's just talk about therapy for a second. I would encourage someone who is going into a therapy type situation to be open and vulnerable with someone, as long as, and this is super important, that person has certain letters after their name.
What?
Letters like LPC. So for instance, if you go to a mega church and they say, here at such and such, the gathering or whatever, I don't know whatever the name of the church is.
Church Co.
We offer counseling services. You need to make sure that if you meet with somebody in that type of environment, that person has certain letters after their name. Letters like LPC, which stands for Licensed Professional Counselor. Those types of letters, that ensures you that a person has a degree in counseling, and that ensures you that person has put in anywhere between 2,000 and 4,000 hours of actual therapeutic training with clients. They can't get those letters after their name unless they have trained, unless they have met certain criteria and stuff like that. If you meet with a counselor who has professional letters after their name, then I would encourage openness and vulnerability. If you meet with somebody and you don't like the therapy that you're receiving there, or the way that person works or something, you get to not meet with them anymore and you can try somebody else. This whole thing that I'm trying to lay out is, vulnerability is an incredibly important thing when you are vulnerable with someone who has demonstrated trust. That's the key. Don't give away a ton of who you are and the depth of who you are to people who have not shown themselves to be trustworthy. You do not owe somebody the backstage pass to the depths of who you are simply because they are like a, they are an associate pastor of the church that you attend. You do not owe somebody a backstage pass because they are the spouse of someone in ministry or something like that, or they run a small group at their house. That does not, these are not the kinds of credentials that mean that you open yourself up to vulnerability. Now, when you are in a situation with someone who has demonstrated trust or someone who does have certain letters after their name, I think vulnerability is an incredibly powerful thing. Because if you are in a situation where you are safe and you know that you can open up your heart, then you can really do some good work on who you are and experience some growth in terms of the things that have happened to you and moving further along the journey that you're in. So I encourage vulnerability, but I encourage it in an environment where there is demonstrated safety and trust.
I think that's a really fantastic way to put that. I will add, before we throw to Jed, I'll add one caveat to Lee's very, very good point about people with letters after their names. If those letters are MDiv,
That's not the letters we're talking about.
Yeah, nope. An important point there. All great stuff from Lee there. And Jed, where do we close this out?
This is great stuff. Just a couple of quick thoughts. I think for the question asker, the fact that you're recognizing that vulnerability is a skill that you can develop, I think you're actually well on your way just in realizing that. And so I would encourage you in places that are healthy and that make sense, just like Lee is saying, to build to it. Vulnerability is a matter of degrees. It is not on or off. There's not such a thing as I am being vulnerable. Now I'm not, you know, vulnerability is it again, it's a matter of degrees. You can think of percentages if you want. One of the things to think about is that vulnerability is a calculated risk. Anytime you are vulnerable with another human being, they could misuse that. This is the truth. However, you can't really have intimacy with other human beings without vulnerability. And so it's a terrible idea to try to live a life with no intimacy of any kind anywhere. So we're going to have some vulnerability somewhere if we're going to have a good life. And so we kind of have to embrace the idea of a calculated risk and then ask, do we know in a given situation how much you are comfortable risking? And there's not a right or wrong on that. It really actually does come down to your comfort level. I'm comfortable sharing this much about the situation. I'm not comfortable sharing more than that. If you want to grow, provided, and again, this is assuming you found a place that is safe, that you found people that are trustworthy. To grow, it's about finding that comfort level, that place where, like, that's about where I'm comfortable sharing, and then pushing just a little bit past that. Not massively, not night and day, not going from 0 to 100, just I'm comfortable giving you 50%. Let me give you 52, just as a way to try and stretch myself a little bit. And here's the next part, is that your comfort level may mean a few different things, right? So your comfort level could have to do with the subject area itself. You know, I'm comfortable talking about my dating life, but I'm not comfortable talking about my health. Your comfort level could have to do with literally the amount of time you spend talking. You know, if someone asks me how I'm doing, I'm happy to share for 30 seconds. I'm not happy to share for 30 minutes. Or it might have to do with the kinds of emotions that you're disclosing. You know, maybe plenty of guys are comfortable talking about their anger, but they're not comfortable talking about their sadness, as an example. Any of these are areas you can choose to grow in. The more that you recognize what makes you comfortable and what makes you uncomfortable, the more you can dial in where growth could occur and what makes sense. If you're a person, and dude, I can certainly be this way, I don't like talking about myself. I've had to do a lot of work to get to a place where when people ask me, you know, hey, Jed, how you doing? I haven't seen you in a while. Or I just go, I'm fine, and then stare at them.
Leave me alone.
Yeah, exactly.
Smoke bomb runs the other way.
My internal barometer of I have shared more about myself than I want to starts to kick in at about the 30-second mark. It turns out that's not conducive to even good professional relationships, much less other things. So for me, you know, there's an element of time of, like, I'm going to push myself to talk a bit longer, not 90 minutes, but a bit longer than what my brain says, clam up, Brewer. But if for you, it's more of like, hey, I'm comfortable saying when something pisses me off, but when something makes me sad, like, you know, that feels hard. What would it mean to push yourself just a little bit on sharing, again, with trusted people on when something makes you sad, or sharing just a little bit about an area of your life that you normally don't? Because if you're doing that with people who have demonstrated trustworthiness, what you'll probably find is it wasn't the end of the world. The first time you do it, it may not be a thing of like, I feel great. It may just be, I shared more than I normally would, and the world didn't end and nothing bad happened. And that's great. That's a beautiful first step, and we can build on that, and we can eventually get to a place where we feel more okay with it. But again, if you're going into this saying vulnerability is something I can build, it's something that I can grow in, then your work's halfway done at that point. If you focus on finding the kind of trust-based, appropriate environments that Lee described, man, you are going to grow in this a ton, and it's going to be a really good thing for your life.
Absolutely agree. I think that's fantastic stuff from both of these guys. One thing I'll add here is vulnerability is not an on or off switch. Yep. And there's a concept of a live omission, which we've talked about on the show and is a thing, but much more a thing in a relationship that already has some established intimacy in those situations. You know, if your partner, or if you're, you know, your husband or wife or your long-term partner asks you, you know, how was your day? And you're like, it was fine. And you leave out, You know, I smashed the car into a light pole, so we're gonna have to deal with that at some point. That's definitely a live omission. When you're dealing with establishing relationships or in a group, just because you don't share everything doesn't mean you didn't share anything.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, if it's coming up on the holidays and somebody asks, hey, you know, what was Christmas like at your house when you were a kid? If it was awful for any number of reasons, you don't have to get into every reason why it was awful and why you hate Christmas. You can just say it was not my favorite and maybe share a small funny story of a small thing that happened and read how they vibe with that. If they say, oh, yeah, it was rough for me, too. And here's another funny story of a thing that happened when, you know, the grandpa got drunk and fell down and we were all horrified because he went face down in the mashed potatoes or whatever. Now we can build some of this vulnerability because that can be a two-way road. You don't have to just trauma dump the first time anyone asks you anything or it didn't count. And when you're kind of evaluating, am I keeping my walls up or not? It's okay to keep a little wall up the first time. You don't have to bring the blast shields all the way down. And that's an important thing to remember when it comes to vulnerability. All right, we're going to move on to our second question. Here it comes in and says, what can I do to deal with controlling parents as an adult? A great question. And Lee, where do we start off here?
Wow, great question. You need ultra clear boundaries with your parents. And just as a reminder, we talk about boundaries a lot on this show. So let's just do a refresh on that. To set a boundary in a relationship with someone is not something that you do to control their behavior. It is something that you do to demonstrate what you will or will not do. So, if there is some place in your life where your parent, you are a grown person, and your parent is trying to command or manipulate what you will do, then you need to let them know what you won't or will do. In certain situations, that takes clear communication. It does take some boldness, but you have got to be clear in this is what I will or this is what I won't do. You need ultra clear boundaries. A lot of the folks that listen to this show already know this, but my wife and I have three children, and two of them are over the age of 18, which is really crazy to say, because when we started recording this podcast, they were little children. but yeah, so one of them's 20 and one of them is 18. And to be perfectly honest, when they were both at the age of around 13, my wife Christy and I went on an intentional program of starting to turn their responsible decisions over to them. We were incredibly intentional about, we want you to be making decisions about your own life so that you can make some big mistakes while you're still under our roof, learn from those things, and you have a soft place to land and all of that kind of stuff, and people still footing the bill and whatever, and we can talk about things and learn about things, and we want to increasingly turn more and more of the decisions of your life over to you so that by the time you're ready to move out, you are in a great place to be able to manage and think about your own life and how you spend your money and how you spend your time and how you get sleep and how you, you know, manage, you know, sleep and study and friends and all of those kinds of things. I'm not telling you that we did it perfect, but I will tell you this, not very many people that raise kids think that way. Not very many parents deal with their children that way. And I have very dear friends who have, not kidding you, 22-year-old married children, and they are still trying to control how they spend time on social media and stuff like that. And man, I can't even form a sentence right now. That is so upsetting to me. You need to establish some clear boundaries with your parents so that you can let them know what you will or will not do. Here's the other thing, and this is incredibly important. You need to get yourself to a place where you are financially independent from your parents. If you are grown and you have a parent who is overbearing and controlling, then you need to find a plan and a strategy to get yourself to be financially independent. If you have no idea how to do that, please reach back out to us and we can help you develop some strategies and kind of a calendar and help you look for a job and all those kinds of things so that you can get to a place where you are financially independent. Because the reason that I say that is if mom is still paying your rent, it is going to be very difficult for you to establish some strong boundaries about what you will or won't do. If you have controlling parents and they are buying your groceries or you are living in their house or they are paying your car insurance or you are on their phone plan, all of those kinds of things are going to massively hold you back from being able to get out from underneath their controlling attitude. So we need to establish some clear boundaries and we need to make a plan starting today on how to get financially independent. And those are the two biggest things for you to get out from underneath kind of the thumb of a hyper controlling parent as an adult.
I think those are excellent, excellent places to start. And Jed, where do we close this out?
No, man, that's really, really good stuff. Lee has an absolute huge expertise on this stuff. And I just want to encourage you to go back and re-listen to everything that he said. You know, the question that I would ask you, which he's already, you know, thoroughly explored, is are they trying to control you or are they succeeding at controlling you?
Mm.
Because those are two very, very different situations. I mean, the way to know is your life tied to theirs or not? You know, what is their leverage over you, right? So, I mean, like, I got plenty of people in the world that are not fans of me for all kinds of reasons, but none of them have the ability to turn off my cell phone. So I don't really have to care what they think, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I got people that aren't too fond of me and they don't have the ability to tell me I can't live in my home anymore. So, my concern over that is pretty low. I think one thing that I want to say to you, because the following is not a, you know, I'm hardcore and I don't even care, but just so you know where I'm coming from, man, I'm a really rebellious person, or at least I have been in most of my life or pockets of it. And so, like, needing my parents to approve of me, honestly, is not something that is really a thing for me. So it's in a sense kind of easy for me to be like, I'll tell you what I do. And I probably do mean those things, but if you are used to having your parents' approval and the idea of like suddenly not having that, and that feels like an overwhelming thing, like what would I do if, you know, my parents told me they didn't love me or they told me I was a disappointment or they told me they hated me or they told me to drop dead or whatever. There's a fear in your head of literally the worst that could happen. And I want to encourage you with two thoughts on the worst that could happen. The first is it's not very likely that the worst would happen. The worst doesn't happen very often. And so you should put together a really good, really wise plan, like what Lee has described to you, and hope for the best. And the odds of the worst happening are pretty dang low, man. So that's good news. But here's the really, really important part. And this is not fun, but I promise you it's the truth. If the worst happens, you'll be okay. If the absolute worst happens, you'll be okay. What the worst is kind of up to you, because you'd have to define it. But your parents say, we don't love you. You're not our child anymore. We hate you. We never want to speak to you again. Whatever it is, maybe it's a combination of those things. You'll be okay. You won't be okay right away. Like, in when that first happens, it's going to feel awful. But you'll be okay. And there are some things in life that are, they are calculated moves where this might be really super unpleasant in the short term, but it's the only way to get to the kind of life that I want for myself. A life where other people are making your decisions for you is probably not a good way to live your life. If you happen to be in the extraordinarily rare situation that you have parents that want to make all your decisions for you, but they're almost all decisions you would make anyway, so you feel great about it. And so, hey, let's not rock the boat. And plus, I'm inheriting $100 million, and I don't want to mess that up either. If you happen to be that one in a billion person for whom that's true, A, I'm happy for you. B, if you could loan me like a 50 spot, that would be great. And yeah. C, carry on. If you're not in that situation, figuring out how to live your own life is almost certainly a part of having a life that you feel good about. If the worst happens, it's not likely, but if the worst happens, you'll be okay. And I think one of the things that I want to encourage you to have as a part of your plan is, who are the people that you're going to lean on if the worst does happen? Who are the people that are going to be a support to you so that you know you're not alone if the worst happens? Those should be people that are decently mature human beings. Those should be people who have their heads screwed on straight. And two other things about those people. The first is, they should not be people that are going to turn around and try and champion your parents' cause. That's super important, because again, if things get ugly, you will absolutely have people try and champion your parents' cause. And it would be good to have a sense of who those people are and who those people are not. But they also need to be people who are level-headed, because when things get ugly, there is a kind of person who has in their mind that if they just do something really extreme, they can solve this whole thing. Like, if I show up at somebody's work and yell at them, or if I, you know, kick somebody's dog or whatever, there's a lot of wannabe heroes in the world. And that's not gender limited. That's men and women both. You don't need any wannabe heroes in your life. If you're learning to draw firm boundaries with potentially significant consequences, you want people who are level-headed, who understand these things can take a very, very, very long time to process all the way through. But again, you'll be okay. Have a plan, get those people that have your back and that can support you in that. Do the things that are wise and that make sense. Trust that it probably won't be the worst, but even if it is the worst, you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. I would tie what Jed said there back to where Lee started us, which is financial independence. So there is what Jed is saying when he refers there to, if the absolute worst happens, you will be okay, is, I believe, if the absolute worst happens from an emotional standpoint, you will survive that. You will come off as a functional human being. You will be okay in the long run. It will be painful. If the worst is you being homeless, you might be okay in the long run, but that's something we want to really put in the effort to try to avoid.
100%.
So things like financial independence, whether that's, saving up for first and last month's rent, whether that's getting a better job, whether that's in an extremely long-term sense, you know, saving up so you can get the certificate that helps you get the better job. And maybe that's a couple year process, super unpleasant. But we want to get to the point where the only negative outcomes are going to be emotional, because that is going to be A, enough to deal with in the first place, and B, allow you to apply all the other great advice these guys gave you. With that, we'll move on to our final question here. It comes in and says, how do you have grace for someone who you think is doing their best but still acting manipulative and weird toward you? I think this is a great question. Obviously a different question than the parent one, but I think parenting is a arena in which this idea comes up. We've talked over the years to a lot of adults who's look back at their childhood and land on the nicest thing they can say about their parents is, well, they tried, and that's good. It's good to try, but then there's a gap between what they tried and what they were trying to do. And yeah. I think there's a lot that can land in there. So Lee, where would we go with that?
Yeah. This is a really interesting question. And I'm glad you wrote it in. I'm actually just really glad to get a chance to talk about it, because it's something that I've experienced as a person who just, you know, having been in a lot of church stuff. There's kind of an attitude in church stuff that is like, well, I want to assume that the people that are part of this thing have their heart in the right place. And so you, you know, if you start there, you can wind up excusing a lot of stuff because I assume this person has their heart in the right place. And I have experienced people who, on the surface maybe seemed like their heart was in the right place. And then over time, you know, just realizing, man, there is a lot of out of bounds stuff in this relationship. Oh my goodness. This other person is experiencing the same thing with them that I did. Oh my goodness. Look at this other situation. That's completely out of bounds. And you realize, I think this person's unhealthy. And I think a lot of us have been putting up with it for a long time. Okay. So that's kind of me saying I've experienced some of this. And so I'm glad you're writing it in. I want to talk about it. Some of my answer to this question is going to sound a lot like my answer to the first question, the second question that was asked tonight, which is you need, with someone that you realize is being manipulative with you, you need ultra, ultra clear boundaries. You only have so much energy in your life, and you do not owe any of your time or your energy to someone who is trying to manipulate you, use you, or try to get you to spend your time or energy doing something you don't want to do. You don't owe any energy to that. Now, in the last question, one of the things that I said was you need to get yourself to a place with your overbearing parent or whatever where you're financially independent. Okay. I'm going to say a similar thing that's not about finances. You need to get yourself to a place where you are thumbs up independent, where you do not need this person's thumbs up over your life. That's the thing that you need to get to. There are people in relationships who are unhealthy, and they manage to manipulate people in their life because, for whatever reason, everybody wants their approval. You need to get to a place where you are approval independent. Now, I'm going to say something that's going to sound weird for a Christian podcast, but I'm telling you, it helped me massively in certain relationships where I was either approval dependent or I was being manipulated for a long time because I just tried to have a good attitude about certain relationships. And this actually is extremely personal to my two co-hosts. I was at a restaurant in Knoxville with Jed because Jed and Hallie were visiting East Tennessee. And I laid out kind of the history of this relationship. And Jed gave me a gift, which I really, really needed to untether myself from a toxic relationship, which was he used hyperbole to completely expose how ridiculous this relationship was. We sat over some fried food and made fun of them. Now, I know that's bad. That sounds like bad advice for a Christian podcast. Okay.
We would never dedicate a quarter of each episode to mocking things.
It doesn't even sound like
us. We expect
nothing
less from our listeners.
Listen, we used hyperbole and sometimes not hyperbole at all to completely make fun of this toxic relationship that I was in. Here's what was fantastic about that. We found what was funny about it, and we laughed about it, and it got me to a new emotional space. And I want you to lean in for this, because your question was, how do I have grace for someone who is, maybe they're doing their best, but they're acting in manipulative or weird ways toward you? When we made fun of this whole situation, the toxicity of it, it got me to an amazing and miraculous place. And I experienced the same thing with Matt in a phone conversation. Matt didn't come down for the fried food. It got me to the place of pity. And that, my friend, is a massive gift.
Yeah.
When someone who you have been giving the benefit of the doubt to, when you realize, I have given this person too much tether, and somebody helped me make fun of them a little bit, and I realized, I need to have pity for you, but I do not, and I will not. I do not need to, and I will not any longer give you any more of my energy. That is a gift. I do not need your thumbs up. I do not need your approval. I do not need to spend any more energy or time on this relationship because I pity you. That is a fantastic gift. And for me personally, the way I got there was fried food, a long phone conversation, and a few good laughs. And when I saw the ridiculousness of it, I was able to pity them. Now, some people might think, man, that's a super unchristian response. I defy you to read the Gospels and tell me that Jesus doesn't use a lot of hyperbole to expose a lot of nonsense.
Yep.
He did it constantly. He used a lot of humor. He used a lot of hyperbole to expose a lot of nonsense. He used it in his parables. He used it in his teaching. Because sometimes you need to see how extreme and ridiculous something is and laugh about it to just change the channel and get yourself in a totally different headspace about it. I was in relationships where I was just giving people too much tether because I was trying to be a good Christian about it. I was trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, and they do good work, and they seem like great folks. But when we were able to laugh about it, I realized, oh no, I pity them. This is ridiculous and toxic, and I will no longer give any more energy, any more time, or any more space to being treated this way or being manipulated in this way. Find somebody that can help you laugh. Find yourself a way to get to the place of pity. Pity is a generous emotion, folks. I know that sounds very strange, but that is a generous emotion for people who are toxic. It actually gets you to a place where you can do what Jesus said about people who basically become your enemy, which is where you pray for them. You feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for you. I actually pray for you. I pray that God will give you the grace to change. It's actually a pretty holy thing. I know we got there in a long roundabout way, but it really, really helped me to grow in some relationships that were super toxic that I needed to get out of.
Extremely well put. Jed, where we close this out?
Offer just a couple little things. Loved everything that Lee said. So the question writes, how do you have grace for someone who you think is doing their best but still acting manipulative and weird toward you? I think the details of how you do that depend on the specifics of the situation. The details really matter. I will say, and this goes right along with everything Lee is saying, offering grace to people is so much easier when they aren't messing up your life. And in fact, I would kind of say, if you want to love a troubled person, step one, and this definitely relates to our previous question, step one is getting into a situation where they don't have a practical impact on your life. The easiest way to think of it is you think of like a little kid that's like really upset, throwing a tantrum and just kind of swinging their arms, trying to hit anything around them. Like, you should take a step back away from that kid to where you're no longer in striking range. Right. But just in general with troubled people, get yourself in a situation where they aren't actively making your life worse. They're not costing you. You know, they're not shutting off your cell phone or getting kicked out of your apartment, or, you know, the police are not involved. You know, they're not ruining your night, you know, blah, 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 blah. Once they aren't messing up your life, actually, that's when we can begin to look at grace. Until that point, it's really a separate discussion. Lee already said it. It bears repeating. Boundaries are always a good idea. The next good idea is limiting exposure. I know plenty of people who are troubled people, some of whom I love very, very deeply, who step one was get it to where they can't mess up my life anymore. Step two is figure out how long can you behave before the really bad stuff starts to come out. For some of them, that's about 20 minutes. For some of them, it's about 24 hours. But the people in my life that I want to have a relationship with who are also deeply troubled, I know what that number is. And I give you a little bit under that. I'm not giving you the full amount, just in case you're having a bad day. I absolutely know people where you could have a 10-minute phone call, but that's all that you get, because I know that's all you can handle. I've got people where I'm happy to visit you for one evening, and then I am leaving immediately the next morning, because that is all you are capable of before the real, real, real bad behavior starts. Depending on the nature of the manipulation, I think deciding in advance, kind of, you can think of it as, what am I willing to spend is important, and then stick with it. Give you an example of what I mean is there are people who have an addictive level disorder with gambling. Let's set that aside for a second. If that's not you, the best way to have fun at a casino is to decide before you go the amount of money that you want to spend. Bring only that amount of money. And when it's gone, which it will be because no one actually wins anything, when it's gone, you're done. It doesn't actually matter what the amount is. For you, maybe that's $10. For somebody else, maybe it's $1,000. I can't really imagine that, but I'm sure there's someone for whom that's not a big deal. But it's deciding in advance and then sticking with it. I'm going to have $10 worth of fun at this casino, whether it takes me 20 minutes or a couple hours, but when it's gone, it's gone. Dealing with troubled people is often a similar thing of like, I have X amount of emotional energy to deal with this person's weirdness, and I'm budgeting it. When it's gone, I'm done. They might not have used up their time allotment yet, but they have used up the emotional energy. So when that is done, when we hit that mark, I am going to be mindful of that and I'm going to leave. I'm going to end the conversation. I can do so gracefully, like, oh gosh, look at the time. It sure has been grand, but there's an amount that I am willing to spend on this. I have no interest in going over that. And the one other thing that I would offer that I think can be useful with all of that, Christians have kind of ruined the idea of an accountability partner because they've made it into this really super weird purient thing that's only about sex and generally set up in ways that are just kind of odd. But having people in your life that are going to ask you about a thing can be really valuable. I mean, like, there's plenty of people that have workout buddies for exactly that reason, you know, but it can be anything. You know, I want to do a little bit more reading in my life, and I got a buddy at the office, and we check in with each other each morning of like, yeah, did you get to do your reading last night? Right. If you know that you've got people you need to interact with and you need to kind of stick to a budget, whether it's time or emotional energy or something else, having someone who you know and you trust who's aware of that situation, who can check in with you afterwards, be like, hey, were you able to keep it in budget, can actually be a really, really useful thing. You don't have to have that. And if you don't know someone where that makes sense, that's okay, but that can be a useful thing. But I just want to go all the way back to your question itself and just let you know that I think you're doing really amazing because, again, you've already laid out the dynamic, which is, yes, they're doing their best. That doesn't erase the fact that they're being manipulative and a weirdo. Those two things can be true at the same time. I do want to show grace towards them, but that's not the same as me just putting up with whatever they want to do. You've got those big picture items already figured out, which means it's really just the mechanics of how you live it out. Lee's given you a lot of great stuff on that. Hopefully my stuff is helpful too. As you mold that to the specific circumstances of your situation, I think you're going to find some things that work really well.
Absolutely right. I think that's fantastic stuff from both of these guys. And I would go back to the beginning where Lee started us with the benefit of the doubt. As he said, that can be a good thing, that could be a charitable thing, but it can also get you caught in some cycles if you're not willing to really evaluate what you're doing in that. So, you know, you mentioned in your question, someone who's doing their best. When you say someone is doing their best, that's good. That's I think that is graceful and a charitable way to look at things. That's also not saying they're doing good. In some ways, it is a bit of a judgmental statement. I think a fair one in a lot of cases, because here's the thing. When I've, in my own life, been talking to people and talked about someone who was doing their best, oftentimes what that can free you from is the idea that if I just explain myself correctly or impart on them how hard this is being on me, then they will access this magical reserve where they can do better. But they will kind of, if I set the boundary right or explain this just right or whatever, or they, you know, have a good night's sleep or whatever external factor happens, this person will reach into this reserve of ability to be a normal person and really rise to the occasion. And in a lot of ways, what someone who's still acting funky is doing their best is saying is, we don't have to be mad at them necessarily because they're not, you know. Here's a phrase I heard a lot as a child in school. I just don't feel that you're really living up to your potential. And I was, you know, that's meant to say that there's something more you can do if you really apply yourself. What if these people are living up to 100% of their potential and this is what you get? That can be a seemingly judgmental idea, but the other thing it gives you is the information to make decisions about. Because if they could just turn around and be a lot better than this, then hey, we can't write this off yet, or we can't really make decisions based on what they're showing us, because it could get a lot better. But if this is them at 100% of their capacity, we need to make plans and evaluations based on what we're seeing in front of us right now, because this is all we can comfortably say there is going to be. And it kind of takes back again where Lee started us with, I know that is a seemingly unkind way to evaluate someone, but it really can lead to more kindness and boundary going forward, because you're not saying, I know there's something more in there. If you can just access it, because maybe there's not, and maybe there's a reason they're not accessing it, and you're going to bring a lot more harm to, a lot more a headache, at least to yourself and probably them, if you try to live with that fictional, if you're trying to coax out that fictional version of the other person, as opposed to dealing with the hand that they're showing you. All right, with that, we are going to close out. Thank you for listening. If you have a question for us, say that podcast at gmail.com, thebridgechicago.tumblr.com/ask. Take out the song this week. You know, this is the least explicitly Christian album Jed has put out, so close enough to devil music. This is a song called The Easy Part is Hard. Thanks for listening to this. Remember, we love you. God loves you. There's nothing you can do about it.
I am the undisputed master of the first of several steps. It's everything past the overture that keeps me stuck in check. When it's time to say how bad we are, I'm the first in line to repent. I'll admit I'm evil, just give me the time and revival to sin. Down to my cancer, I'm not so sure I want to be healed. It's not that I don't know it's killing me. Believe me, yes I do. Set somewhere deep inside my heart, I can't believe that it's killing. I know you're cold to me, and I have heard the propaganda, but it's the punishment I believe. I know you gave me everything, I just want a little more. I only ask because I lack a heart that feels your love. I